From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, a Holocaust survivor and a man whose every step away from the nightmare of concentration camps became a determined step against genocide and the Nazi killers of Jews. Simon Wiesenthal died last night in Vienna. He was 96. For more than 50 years, Simon Wiesenthal tracked down Nazi war criminals, 1,100 of them by his own estimates, from SS leader Adolf Eichmann to the Nazi commandant at Treblinka to the policeman he believed arrested Anne Frank. Simon Wiesenthal became an outspoken critic of racism and neo-Nazism, a voice for those who died in the camps, an icon called the conscience of the Holocaust.
I know this war deformed me. I am not the same that I was before the war. I am a religious man. And maybe the religion is true that they say that after our world is another world too. We will come to this other world. And before me, I will see these millions. And they will ask what you have done after our death. I think I will be only from this few people that can say them, I never forget you.
This hour, On Point, the life and work and message of Nazi hunter Simon Wiesenthal. You can join the conversation. What did you see in this tireless pursuer of Holocaust justice? Did Simon Wiesenthal bring justice, or at least some comfort to you, to your family? And how would you describe the legacy of the man who called himself a deputy for the dead? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Los Angeles is Rabbi Marvin Heyer, a longtime friend of Simon Wiesenthal and dean and founder of the Simon Wiesenthal Center. Rabbi Heyer, thanks for being with us.
I'm honored to be here to say a few words about one of the greatest humanitarians and human rights advocates that we've had in the 20th and 21st century, Simon Wiesenthal. He was quite a remarkable individual. He was an individual when he started. He never imagined that this would be his work. He was an architect by profession. He thought he would be beautifying communities by building homes. Instead, his lot was to bring to justice those who had destroyed communities. And he, much to the disbelief, many people thought, well, he must have had a background as a detective, as an investigator. Absolutely not. He simply was determined that he was going to do something about it. When he was in Mauthausen concentration camp, he kept a list on a crumpled piece of paper of Nazi guards who had committed grave atrocities, and weighing less than 90 pounds, a day after the war ended, May 9th, 1945, he brought that list to U.S. Army intelligence, which began his career. And he did it not because of vengeance. He told me many, many times, my work is not to get even. It was to say that there is such a law of justice. Because, he said, what I'm doing is not because of the past. It's to protect my grandchildren and great-grandchildren. It's to send a warning to would-be murderers of tomorrow that the world is not prepared to acquiesce to crimes against humanity without doing anything about it.
Rabbi Heyer, I wanted to ask you about this word justice. It was so often on Simon Wiesenthal's lips, and yet, when you have 11 million dead, 6 million Jews, did he think that justice was possible? The scale of the genocide was so large. How does one define justice? How did Simon Wiesenthal?
Well, he didn't, you know, of course, was it equal justice? Were all the murderers apprehended? Of course not. There were so many people murdered, one-third of all the world's Jewish population. But it was a measure of justice, is the way he spoke of it. And he said it's not only the ones that were that he found, even the ones that escaped, they too lived life differently because of him. he said, if I gave them a sleepless hour, that too was a small measure of justice, that they would have to think maybe tomorrow there'll be a knock on my door. And when he started, nobody helped him. You know, people were very skeptical. And even those who were in the camps, they said to him at the time, Simon, are you crazy, dedicating your life to become a Nazi hunter? You have an opportunity to go back to a normal life. And his wife used to say to him that you're not only married to me, you're married to the 6 million. And Simon would say, my wife was right. He just could not let go of the fact that 89 members of his own family, that he'd been in the camps, that he saw the suffering, unimaginable suffering. There's the scene where he couldn't say goodbye to his mother. She was taken on a cattle car to be exterminated. He knew she was on that car. He ran after it to say goodbye. She never heard him. And what is his legacy? His legacy, you know, it's often the cliche and it's overused, but it is absolutely true regarding Simon Wiesenthal. How one man made a difference in this world. He started out in 1945. No one ever heard of Simon Wiesenthal then. He passed away at 96, and there isn't a person, whether it's a world leader or on university campuses, professors, there isn't a person in the world that could say they never heard of Simon Wiesenthal.
Give us some insight into the character. Many people, millions, died in the camps, but many also came out. There's only one, really, who came out with the kind of determination, with the kind of mission that Simon Wiesenthal pursued. What was it about him as a man, as a survivor, that put him in particular on this path that made him the foremost Nazi hunter?
I think he just couldn't shake the memory, and he determined he had to do something about it, and he also saw that the world was going back to business as usual. The war ended, and all the headlines were about the Cold War. And already people were saying, you know, the Nazis, that's ancient history. We have new concerns and problems. And he just thought that to have witnessed the greatest crime ever committed in all of human civilization, and to have a world say, let's go on with other things and forget about that, just rubbed him the wrong way. He just couldn't shake that. Many people try to talk him out of it. And he always tells that story, which is, you know, the story that that was repeated on the, which I heard on your, at the beginning of this broadcast, which is, and that story was on a Friday night when he was with friends. And there were candles, you know, put on because of it was Shabbat. And they started saying what they were going to do after the war. And one said they're going to go into building homes. Another said they're going into the jewelry business. One said the manufacturing business. He looked through the candles, and that's when he said to them, he said, you know, he said, I'm a religious man, and I believe that the 6 million will ask us, what have you done? He said, you'll tell them, you went back to the manufacturing business and you became a jeweler and you went to build homes. But only I amongst you will have the privilege to tell the 6 million, I have never forgotten you. Said, maybe in that world, I may be the rich man.
Rabbi Heyer, let me ask you, Simon Wiesenthal insisted that the Simon Wiesenthal Center be dedicated to all the 11 million people of different nationalities, races, creeds, who had died at the hands of Nazis, as I understand, not just the 6 million. He's quoted as saying, I'm not dividing the victims. That became, later in his life, a controversial position. Why did he stake it out that way?
Well, since I knew him extremely well, yes. I could tell you his position was he did not believe that the suffering, what do I mean, but that the plans of the Nazis were equal plans. He didn't deny the fact, that no one could, that the Wannsee Conference was convened to do away with the world Jewish population. Mm. That was the purpose of the Wannsee Conference. Mm-hmm. The final solution of the Jewish question, it was not the final solution of any other ethnic group.
Mm.
His point, however, was that when we recognize the 6 million Jews who were brutally murdered in the Nazi Holocaust, let us not forget the other victims of other faiths, though they may not have been the original intention of the Wannsee Conference. In other words, he did not deny the fact of the uniqueness of the Holocaust, that the Wannsee Conference was against the Jews.
Mm-hmm.
His point was, it doesn't matter. What matters is that you should remember the other victims equally, because the Jews were the first victims of the Nazis. Had they been successful, had they come to America, for example, they would have gone after African Americans, Latinos, Japanese, anyone who looked different to them, who didn't fit the Aryan, prototype.
Mm.
That was his point.
And he acted on that point right around the world with great effect. Rabbi Marvin Heyer, dean and founder of the Simon Wiesenthal Center in Los Angeles. We're going to hear a lot more in this hour. We know we have to let you go. We thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Rabbi Marvin Heyer. We're talking about the remarkable life of Simon Wiesenthal, the 20th century supreme Nazi hunter. You can join us in this hour. What does justice for 1,000 or 1,100 Nazi war criminals mean for the millions that died? What did it mean for you? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking this hour about the remarkable life of Simon Wiesenthal, the Holocaust survivor and Nazi hunter who called himself the Deputy for the Dead. He was probably best known for helping to track down SS leader Adolf Eichmann. Here, Simon Wiesenthal, who died last night in Vienna at 96, offers some thoughts about the man who organized the extermination of the Jews.
You know, I have the unpublished memoirs of Eichmann. He read it, I think, 3 years before he was arrested. And he tell a story that the fall, 44, before they left Budapest, I was sitting with comrades and they asked him what will be after the war when the world will claim for the millions. He said, 100 dead people is a catastrophe. 1 million dead people is a statistic. And he was right. You cannot imagine 1 million dead people. One child like the Anne Frank, you can imagine.
Simon Wiesenthal on Adolf Eichmann. Simon Wiesenthal died in Vienna last night. This hour we look at his legacy and his work, his mission, his view of justice after genocide. You can join the conversation. Do you remember when the arrests fueled by Simon Wiesenthal made world headlines, when Wiesenthal and post-war Nazis on the run? And does your family have a story of loss and justice after the Holocaust, of justice done and what it meant? You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Can there be justice for genocide? Did you cheer Simon Wiesenthal on? We heard earlier in this hour from Rabbi Marvin Heyer, founder of the Simon Wiesenthal Center in Los Angeles. We're joined right now from Washington by Martin Mendelson, a longtime attorney for and friend to Simon Wiesenthal. They met in 1977 and saw each other just last month in Vienna. Martin Mendelson, thank you for joining us. I'm sorry for your loss.
Well, thank you for your sentiment, and I'm in some ways very sorry to be here.
We understand. Also joining us from New York, Rhonda Barad, Eastern Director for the Simon Wiesenthal Center. She joins us from New York City. Rhonda Barad, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you, but I agree with Mr. Mendelson. It's a very sad day for all of us.
It's a sad day, but after a long life and a life with an enormous impact, Martin Mendelson, how do you describe the imprint that Simon Wiesenthal left in the half century after the experience of the Holocaust?
Simon Wiesenthal was the world's conscience. He knew injustice he experienced savagery firsthand, and he was able to rise above it. He was a loud clarion to call people to bear witness, to call people to do justice, to call people to do that which was right. His moral authority, his moral impact is incalculable. And I think that in the next half century, in the next century, people will be reading and remembering and understanding and honoring what Simon Wiesenthal did and what he accomplished.
We want to look back at exactly what he did, but Rona Barad, if I may ask you, and this was a very long-lived man. He outlived some of his biographers. What were his thoughts late in this long life about what he had and had not accomplished?
Well, excuse me, I'm a lot younger than all of you. So, in fact, I wasn't alive when a lot of these Nazis were captured. I've met Simon, but I look to the future and what Mr. Wiesenthal's message meant to all of us, my generation, and the ones that come after me. And I think that is probably one of his most important legacies.
But what is that message? Are you still hunting? Are you still looking for justice? Or is this the other side of the Wiesenthal legacy?
We are still looking for justice. There are still some Nazis out there, and that's done out of our Israel office. But I think that the message has changed. There are still haters. There are still acts of genocide. And the fact that people are put on trial and there are tribunals is one of his legacies. I don't believe that had Simon not been alive to push for this, that we would see the tribunals that we see in The Hague today, and that people who do perpetrate crimes against humanity who are put on trial. I think that is one of his legacies. I also think that the other legacy is to the young haters of today. I think that if the Nazis had been allowed to go free and if Simon hadn't lived and brought to justice the 1,100 Nazis that he did, they could have said, well, look, the Nazis got away with it, so can we. And I think that that is another lesson. But I also want to point the tape that you played of Simon just before mm-hmm. we came on, mm-hmm. Ended with Anne Frank. I think that one of the greatest legacies that Simon has is the fact that he brought the captor of Anne Frank to justice. And she is the face of the Holocaust, and that book is read around the world. And I think that that is one lasting memory that the youth today will have, and we'll make sure that they know that it was Simon who brought Mr. Silberbauer to justice.
We want to understand some of these stories. As you say, Rhonda, we'll have listeners who really don't know exactly what Simon Wiesenthal did, a younger generation. Let's take that one just for example. The policeman, Carl Silberbauer, Simon Wiesenthal believed he had arrested the Dutch teenager, Anne Frank, and sent her to Bergen-Belsen concentration camp. How did he do his work? How did he track this man down?
I think Mr. Mendelsohn could probably explain that a lot better than I can.
Martin Mendelsohn?
What Simon did in the 40s and 50s was painstakingly collect information. He collected documents, he collected affidavits, he collected statements, he interviewed witnesses, he traveled around Europe, and once he compiled sufficient information, which he would refer to as a dossier, he would then put it all in a neat package and deliver it to the local authorities or to the German authorities or to whoever he thought the appropriate prosecuting authority or police authority should be. And if they did not act quickly enough, he would utilize the press to force the issue, and he did it in ways that brought him some fame and much success. And we are in some ways emulating his methods even to this day by looking at documents, putting pieces of puzzles together. It's harder now. We're not a smarter Simon. But the pieces of the puzzle have been warped by time, so it's harder, even if you are Simon. And Simon was working at home and in his office until very recently. when I saw him in Vienna, I saw him with regularity. Until very recently, we were always discussing some case, some fugitive, some new idea, some new aspect that most of the time he would come up with for me to look at and try to puzzle through.
But in the beginning, when he set out on this path, I mean, we read that this was, it was a very lonely path. I'm looking back here to 1951 when Wiesenthal learned that Adolf Eichmann, the sort of overseer of the Final Solution, had gone to Rome and hidden in a monastery. In 53, he was told that this Nazi leader had been seen near Buenos Aires. He had no resources to search South America. He tried to get people to help him, and really, he later wrote that no one cared about Eichmann.
Well, no one cared about the Holocaust. No one cared about the pursuit of justice for the murder of millions. He, at one point, was forced to close up shop. And this was in the 50s. It was a very hard and bitter time for him.
45 years old, depressed and collapsing physically. His doctor ordering him to rest and give it up for a while. A hard, hard road. A lot of callers want to join this conversation. Martin Mendelson, Rhonda Barad, allow me to bring them in. Jonathan is calling from Amherst, Massachusetts. Hi, Jonathan. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you doing?
Very well.
I wanted to echo what Martin Mendelson just said about the lack of support, but I would take this up even much later. I'm 54 years old, and in 1968, when I was 17, and growing up in a small town north of Boston, and I'm not a child of Holocaust survivors, but I was very cognizant and very politically aware and very aware of the fact that there seemed to be no interest in justice. I mean, I would read articles about, tiny little articles would be in the New York Times about somebody who would be on trial in West Germany, and they would, you know, be alleged to have killed 10,000 Jews, and they'd get like a 3-year prison sentence. And of course, at the time, people my age were getting that kind of sentence for possession of marijuana. But anyway, at that age, at 17, I went to a bank, figured out a way to send an international money order, which wasn't easy at the time, and sent it directly to Simon Wiesenthal, Jewish Documentation Center in Vienna.
Wow.
And I got back a letter from him that was hand-typed by himself with lots of typos in English. He basically said, you know, he had very little support. I wish I had the letter in front of me, but I think I have it somewhere. But it was, like, shocking to me that as late as 1968, there was very, very little support for this issue, and that's like 5-6 years after the Eichmann trial.
That is incredible. I mean, here we saw 1960, Mossad kidnapped or abducted Eichmann from Buenos Aires, took him to Israel. He was hanged. But you're talking a decade later, and Wiesenthal still feeling he's on a lonely road.
Well, not feeling it. It was a reality. I mean, this is way before the Simon Wiesenthal Center was set up. It's way before the U.S. government set up the Office of Special Investigations. There was just, and then I think that we basically, I think the bottom line is what Bob Dylan said in the song, With God on Our Side, we forgave the Germans very, very quickly. That's one of the lines in With God on Our Side by Bob Dylan. Very quickly, without any real accountability, because they were doing these trials of people, you know, up in the 60s, 70s, maybe even into the 80s. And giving people unbelievably light sentences for outrageous crimes against humanity.
And you getting a typewritten letter back as a teenager from Simon Wiesenthal, who was devoting his life to that effort. Jonathan, thank you for your call. Let's get another call here. Joe's on the line from Attleboro, Massachusetts. Hi, Joe. You're on the air. Hello, Joe. Are you there, my friend? Let's take a call from Buffalo, New York. Dave is on the line. Hello, Dave. Are you there?
Good morning. Thank you very much.
Yes.
I just have to say that I don't have words to express my respect for an effort this noble, and his passing is certainly a loss to every one of us. I guess my comment is that it's fairly widely known that the U.S. government or the CIA took pretty dramatic steps to protect many of the former SS in their efforts, in their anti-Soviet espionage efforts.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I'm wondering if your guest can comment on that, how that may have impeded his pursuit. And I'll take your comments off the phone.
Dave, thank you for your call. Martin Mendelson, what about the U.S. Embrace after the war of Nazi officials to help get Germany back off the ground? Certainly not all, but there was that embrace. Mm-hmm. How did Wiesenthal see that?
Oh, absolutely. Simon used to say that the victors in the Cold War were the Nazis, because they ended up being protected by both the communists and by the West, each for its own reason. It was not concealed that we actively recruited Nazis to help us in the Cold War. In the 40s and 50s, not only did we do it, but there were Sunday magazine articles on how smart we were in doing it. There was a collective amnesia. It was clear that people would prefer not to talk about the Holocaust, not to talk about the crimes, not to talk about the fact that we were engaged with people who had perpetrated evil, because there was a greater evil that had to be combated.
What was it that turned the tide on that? Simon Wiesenthal, ultimately, with 1,100 Nazi war criminals brought to justice, clearly at some point this picked up steam in a huge way.
Well, in 77, when Nazi hunting suddenly became respectable in U.S. government circles, and I had the honor of creating the Office of Special Investigations, we were given access to various secret or other classified documents and information, and we were able to peel away some, and I'm not going to say all because we'll never know what all means, but some, most of what the U.S. government was engaged in. We, for example, discovered one of Eichmann's deputies in the U.S. and sought to bring him to trial, and he died before the trial could commence. But we did have, for the first time, levels of cooperation with the intelligence community, both domestic and foreign, that enabled us to collect information, including from the Soviet Union, and use it in U.S. courts.
Eichmann was famously taken back to Israel and hanged. What about the bulk of the 1,100 that Simon Wiesenthal pulled into the light? Did most of them face trial in the country where they had escaped to, or what portion were taken
not,
to Israel?
Not where they escaped to, but where the crimes were committed. That was part of a declaration that the Allies issued in 1943. Those charged with war crimes should be tried in the countries where they were perpetrated. Having said that, there were always exceptions. The last active case that Simon and I worked on was involving Josef Schwamberger, who was a camp commandant at Chemisch in Poland, but because Schwamberger was a German national operating under the aegis of the German military. He was tried in Stuttgart, and Simon and I were both there. Simon was there for a short period of time. I was appointed to represent the victims in the German proceeding and spent 6 months or more in Stuttgart in regular proceedings. But these things did happen, and Simon was actively involved in putting the case together.
Martin Mendelson, Rhonda Barad, please stand by. We're talking this hour about the remarkable life of Simon Wiesenthal, Holocaust survivor, self-appointed deputy for the dead, and a very effective one over many decades. He died last night in Vienna at 96. You can join the conversation. Where did Simon Wiesenthal leave the scales of justice? Where did he leave remembrance? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com, and Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital. For more than 60 years, helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services. In Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the remarkable life of Simon Wiesenthal, the 20th century supreme Nazi hunter, the Holocaust survivor who called himself the deputy for the dead. You can join our conversation. Can there be justice for genocide? Did you cheer Wiesenthal on? Did he succeed in stanching the forgetting, the thing he dreaded most of all? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined in this hour from New York by Rhonda Barad, Eastern Director for the Simon Wiesenthal Center, which is of course, based in L.A., and from Washington by Martin Mendelson, a longtime attorney and friend of Simon Wiesenthal since 1977. In 77, Martin Mendelson created the Office of Special Investigations for the Justice Department, which investigates and prosecutes individuals accused of Nazi war crimes. You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. Does your family have a story of loss and revenge in the Holocaust, of justice done and what it meant? 1-800-423-TALK. Alan's calling from Williamsville, New York. Hi, Alan. You're on the air.
Hi. I just think it should be noted that there's a very large number of Germans today who consider Mr. Wiesenthal to have been a very great man who has focused on the fact that the Nazi Holocaust did a great deal to destroy German-Jewish relations, a 2,000-year history of German-Jewish relations, and that a great many Germans today feel that what he did and what he was doing up to his time of his death was a very valuable service to German-Jewish relations and to the new Germany.
And maybe that this very determined Jewish man helped Germans themselves come to terms with their history.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that there's a sense of gratitude in the many Germans that I know. I've devoted about 20 years to this effort of recreating German-Jewish life. And most of the Germans that I've come in contact with I think would agree that what he has done was not done simply for the world Jewish community or for the 6 million, but it has had great significance to today's Germany.
Alan, thanks very much for sharing your observation. Rhonda Barad, let me turn to you, if I may, on just that front. What about the work of the Simon Wiesenthal Center today in Germany and beyond when it comes to neo-Nazis and the many new arenas where hatred has come out, the web not least. What kind of work? How are you doing your work today?
Well, we have researchers around the world who do monitor the web, and initially it was just on hate and anti-Semitism, and it has expanded to terrorism as well, even since before 9/11, that a lot of these websites, for example, are trying to recruit suicide bombers, and we're working very closely with government agencies as well, with the FBI, with the police departments around the country and around the world. I think one of the problems we have is the United States has different laws, and Mr. Mendelson can certainly add on to this, is that we have the First Amendment here. Many countries do not, and a lot of the materials that are published have to be produced here and distributed there. It's illegal. It's illegal for them to distribute it in their countries, and people go to jail for it. Our laws are much freer.
Martin Mendelson, do you see a legal framework that's effective to the ongoing challenge of hate crimes today?
We don't have enough time to go through that in proper depth. In Germany today, for example, Nazi literature is outlawed, and the office that prosecutes individuals is called the Office for the Protection violation of the federal constitution. Germany feels that it suffered by Nazis who perverted their existing form of government in the 30s, or the 20s and the 30s, and so has become super vigilant and does not feel that it can have the kinds of luxuries that the United States takes for granted.
A much tougher approach there that speaks to maybe our caller's assessment of Simon, in part Simon Wiesenthal's impact right there. Well, let's take another call, if I may. Tammy is calling from Newton, Massachusetts. Hi, Tammy, you're on the air.
Good morning. I think in some cases there was an earlier reference to the question of revenge. And in some cases, particularly among survivors, I know this from my own family, from two great uncles in their 80s and 90s, that revenge was merely a matter of, after the war, living their lives, continuing to have lives, outliving their captors, and having children and grandchildren. That ultimately it became the best revenge that they were not, the Jews were not wiped off the face of the earth.
Yeah, we can well understand that. So what did that leave them, or you, Tammy, think of Simon Wiesenthal's example, which was, again, he says he's looking for justice, not revenge, but it's the same kind of fervor. Is that a different quality of response or simply a different response?
I think it's merely a different response. I think revenge can take many forms. Most often we think of it in kind of a negative tone, a negative connotation. But this is how they turned revenge into a positive that, look at me, I'm still here into the 21st century, and I have children and I have grandchildren that otherwise would not have existed had the Nazis succeeded in their mission.
Many ways of responding, and practically everyone in one corner or another of this planet pursued Rhonda Barad. Do you have a sense of Simon Wiesenthal's attitude toward Holocaust survivors and Jews after the Holocaust who chose a different path, a different way of marking their presence on the earth from him?
Well, as I indicated, I haven't spent a lot of time with Mr. Wiesenthal, but I think he felt that any way that a survivor decided to spend his or her life was an act of survival, just as this woman indicated, is they survived, they had children. We can't replace the numbers that we lost, I don't think. Maybe we will, who knows. But just living is an act of survival and an act of moving on, I believe. I mean, I was at the funeral of a very good friend's father recently, and the one thing that he commented on is what he left for his grandchildren and his future great-grandchildren. But the one thing, and I think that Marty and Rabbi Heyer would agree as well, is Simon is going to have a grave. His wife has a grave, a place that future generations can go to visit. 89 members of his family don't have graves. And I think that's a very hard thing for those of us who didn't live through those times to accept and understand. I lost family. I don't know if Mr. Mendelsohn did. But we have no graves to visit. And that's also the future of our community as well.
Simon,
we have survived. We have thrived. We've gone on to do all sorts of things. But Simon, as Rabbi Heyer said this morning, he didn't forget the Jews that died. This was how he lived his life. And my guess is this is how he remembered his family that died.
His own wife of 67 years, Scylla, died in 2003. He survived by a daughter, Palinka. Mary's calling from Milton, Massachusetts. Hi, Mary, you're on the air.
Hi. You might want to read his book, The Sunflower, which he envied the Germans who died because they had sunflowers planted on their grave. And it's a book about his time in the labor camp and his being released, or his working at a medical station and being asked to forgive a 21-year-old Nazi officer his crimes against the Jews. And he was unable to respond to him. And the second half of the book is about other people responding to his inability to respond, whether he was correct in not forgiving or whether he was wrong. And it's by different people from many faiths and many prestigious positions in life. But it's a wonderful book.
The Sunflower. Thanks for reminding us, Mary. Martin Mendelsohn, what about this issue of forgiveness? Over the years, on different occasions, we've heard from survivors of the Holocaust with quite different views on that. Simon Wiesenthal, I guess, did not hear that song of forgiveness. Or you tell us.
First, with respect to Jews, Simon was remarkably and totally non-judgmental. He accepted all people who were Jews as Jews, period. With regard to others, it was an equal welcoming, but with some judgments as to evil. If you were righteous, if you understood humanity and inhumanity, then you were a friend of Simon's. But if you were a bigot, a racist, intolerant of others, then Simon had nothing to do with you.
And was there any strand of forgiveness, or was he so determined to make examples of Nazi war criminals for future generations that was simply off his screen?
I'm sorry, I have to repeat the question.
Well, did he see a place in particular for forgiveness when it came to those who perpetrated the Holocaust? Or was that just...
It was not off his screen, but his difficulty was accepting the notion that people would forget if individuals were not properly dealt with. He viewed legal proceedings as legal proceedings in one dimension and an educational proceeding in another dimension. And it was important to him that every criminal trial concerning the Holocaust was also a teaching tool about the Holocaust. He insisted on open proceedings. He insisted on publicity. He wanted everyone to know so that everyone would be armed with the knowledge to resist this kind of evil.
Let's take a call. Ed is calling from Braintree, Massachusetts. Hi, Ed, you're on the air.
Good morning. Do we weep and show concern for the 30 million Chinese that were killed under Mao, the 12 million that were killed under Stalin, the 2 million Cambodians, the 3 million Armenians? And I understand this last century, 63 million people were killed under state-sponsored genocide.
Well, how do you see Simon Wiesenthal in that context, Ed? He stood up after his personal experience as a Jew in Europe under the Nazis and spent his life in response to that. Is that enough?
Well, I think his legacy points in that it points to the problem that I think it's good as an indicator for these other things, as long as it keeps those alive in our memory.
Ed, thanks for your call. Rhonda Barad.
If I can comment to that,
yes,
and
please.
To your previous caller, back to The Sunflower. I think one of Simon's legacies is the fact that the book The Sunflower is given out in many colleges around the country as part of their orientation packages. And I think that's really important. It's been going on for 5 or 6 years. The book has been reprinted and reprinted again with new people commenting on forgiveness and what Simon originally wrote.
And what about the larger sad picture of death, unjust death in the 20th century? How do you see his legacy reflecting on that?
As Marty will know, and we can attest, Simon has had many meetings with many different people to discuss the Armenian genocide, the Cambodian genocide. I remember when he came to the United Nations, and I wasn't even at the Simon Wiesenthal Center yet, and held a meeting with the former Secretary General of the United Nations, and I think Marty was at that meeting. He wanted to fight injustices everywhere, using the Holocaust as a stepping stone, which is what we at the Simon Wiesenthal Center do as well.
He said, if we pardon this genocide, it will be repeated, and not only on Jews. If we don't learn this lesson, then millions died for nothing. Let me get one more call, if I may. Kathy's calling from Framingham, Massachusetts. Hi, Kathy. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just wanted to say my parents were survivors, and we lost relatively few of our family, thank goodness. But they weren't able, they died young and weren't able to really take advantage of the wonderful things that Simon Wiesenthal did to bring all of this to light. They didn't talk about it much, and I think it's really important for the rest of the world to know what went on and to have as many people brought to justice and new terrorists and new hate mongers to be brought, to visibility and shown for what they are.
You wish your own parents had been able to see that. We understand, Kathy. Thank you for your call. Martin Mendelsohn, Simon Wiesenthal wanted this not to be forgotten. At the same time, the world turns and goes forward. Was he ever afraid of too great an obsession with this monumental event of the 20th century, or was it just what he was meant to follow up on, period?
I think, to paraphrase an American Supreme Court Justice, Benjamin Cardozo, who said, sunshine is the best insecticide for dealing with vermin. Simon felt that there could not be too great an emphasis on man's evil in order to deter man from pursuing evil in the future. Simon Wiesenthal was a multifaceted individual, trained as an architect. He felt that because of his personal experience, his family history, he had to abandon his career to do this. It was not a smooth road. A man lived as an ascetic. His flat in Vienna is on the outskirts of Vienna. It is a very nondescript, very modest place. This was not something he did for money or glory. This was something he did for justice, for remembrance, for doing the right thing for his fellow man.
And today we remember that legacy. Simon Wiesenthal, dead at 96. Martin Mendelsohn, longtime attorney, friend of Simon Wiesenthal, we thank you for being with us this hour.
Well, thank you.
And Rhonda Barad, Eastern Director of the Simon Wiesenthal Center, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.